The shiur tonight is sponsored by the Honorable Martin and Fran Shulman, marking the yardside tonight of Marty's mother, Evelyn Jean Shulman, Chavo Ito, Basma Shulman Zisho, the Neshama should have an aliyah, Shimosh Nachas Ruach from the Torah, Mitzvahs and Maisim Tovim, that the entire family is involved in. I wanted to speak a little bit tonight about the B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain. We know that the end of Parshas Matos describes how the B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain came to Moshe Rabbeinu. They wanted to take as an inheritance the Eiver HaYarden, the portion on the eastern side of the Jordan River, which had been conquered from Sichon and Og. There's a whole back and forth with Moshe Rabbeinu, and ultimately, after Moshe Rabbeinu chose them out, so to speak, for doing something which in his eyes is treacherous, you know, it's spurning of Eretz Yisrael, they explain that they're going to indeed go over, cross the Jordan River with the rest of the Shvatim, the rest of the tribes. They're going to fight at the head of the armies conquering Eretz Yisrael. And then and only then is Moshe Rabbeinu mollified, and he says, okay, if you're going to do that, so then we can give you these portions of the Eiver HaYarden, and all is going to be well. How do we look at the motivations of the B'nai God, of B'nai Ruvain? Were they inspired L'Shem Shamayim? Did they have spiritual aspirations? Or were there far more materialistic motivations that pushed them to search out and to try to inherit this land on the eastern side of the Jordan River? The impression you get from almost any discussion in Tanakh about the B'nai God, of B'nai Ruvain, is that primarily they were motivated by materialistic considerations. They don't sound very idealistic at all. The parsha itself starts off in Perek Lamed Beis, U'mikne Rav hayo livnei Ruvain v'livnei God. Otzim me'od, B'nai God v'nei Ruvain had massive amounts of cattle. V'yiru eseres yazer v'yaseres gilod v'nei amokom akom mikne. They see the land which was conquered on the eastern side of the Jordan, the land that used to belong to Sichon and Og, and it's perfect land for pasture. And because of that materialistic consideration, it sounds like that's why they're ready to trade their portion in Eretz Yisrael proper in order to get a portion on the eastern side of the Jordan. A few weeks ago in a shiur on the Ramban, Parshas Chukas, I quoted the Ramban there in Parshas Chukas, where the Ramban writes that clearly, the sanctity of the eastern side of the Jordan, although the eastern side of the Jordan is considered to be Eretz Yisrael with regard to some halachas, the sanctity of the eastern side of the Jordan is inferior to the sanctity, the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which is on the western side of the Jordan. And the Ramban writes, and one example of that is that we see that the Shekhinah, God's presence, could really never rest on the eastern side of the Jordan the way it rested on the western side of the Jordan. So it would seem that the B'nai God of B'nai Ruvain, for materialistic considerations, because, you know, it's a better place for the vast amount of cattle which they've accumulated, are basically trading in a spiritually superior portion which they might have had for a spiritually inferior portion that they might have had. That certainly doesn't cast the B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain in a very positive light. They come across, at the best, as being extremely materialistic and ready to put money ahead of spiritual concerns. That sense is reinforced by various different passages in the Tanakh. First of all, right here in Parshas Matos, Moshe Rabbeinu's response to B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain is not, oh, you're such wonderful spiritual people, but he, as we said before, he chews them out. He says, look, you're giving up, you're acting in a way, as he puts it, which is similar to the Meraglim. The Meraglim spurned Eretz Yisrael, and it seems as if you're also spurning the major part of Eretz Yisrael. We keep reading in the Tanakh, we get the Sefer Yehoshua. The Sefer Yehoshua describes how the B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain, in point of fact, actually did. They lived up to their promise to Moshe Rabbeinu. They crossed over the Yarden into Eretz Yisrael. And they actually were Yotzei Chalutz Latzava. They actually went in front of all of the other troops into Eretz Yisrael to conquer Eretz Yisrael. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. But then after the war was over and after the division of Eretz Yisrael was over, after the 14 years of conquest and division were over, the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven returned to the Eber HaYarden, the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they built a huge Mizbeach. They built a huge altar. And this altar brought in its wake an altercation. It brought about machlokas of an incredible degree. It almost created a civil war. Basically, the word reached the other Jews who were on the western side of the Jordan River, and they thought that the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven were setting up an alternative Mishkan. They thought that they were breaking away and making, in a sense, their own religion. They were ready to go to war against the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. And finally, Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven told them, no, we're not looking to make an alternate to the Mishkan. This is not meant to actually offer up karbanos on. This is merely a reminder. It's a facsimile of the Mizveach in the regular Mishkan, and it will always remind us of our connection to our brethren on the western side of the Jordan River. It's meant to connect us, it's not meant to divide us. Okay? So Klal Yisrael accept that. But you see that even there, they were suspicious of the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. And if we assume that the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven didn't have the most spiritual reputation, that they seemed to be motivated primarily by materialistic considerations, you could well understand why Klal Yisrael would be wary, would be suspicious of these two Shvatim, these two tribes, who had exchanged something spiritual for something material. In an even more stark fashion, we find that Chazal give an interesting interpretation of a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk in Mishlei, Perek Chaf, pasuk Chaf Aleph, tells us as follows. Nachla mivoheles barishona, an inheritance which comes quickly initially, v'acharisa lo sivoroch, in the end it's not going to be blessed. What does that mean? So Chazal say, Rashi quotes it there in Mishlei, that this pasuk is actually a reference to the Bnei Gad or Bnei Reuven. Nachla mivoheles barishona. They rushed in to take their portion of their inheritance first, before everybody else. That wasn't such a nice thing. It wasn't proper what they did. And therefore, v'acharisa lo sivoroch, in the end they will not be blessed. How will they not be blessed? It says Rashi, quoting from Chazal, when the Assyrians came to northern Israel and eventually sent the 10 tribes of northern Israel into Golus, the first tribes to be sent into Golos were the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. The Assyrians first came to the eastern side of the Jordan River. They conquered the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, and they sent them off 8 years into Golos. They sent them off into Golos 8 years before they sent the rest of the Aseres HaShvatim, the northern tribes, into Golos. And say Chazal, that was a punishment. You were so quick to run and take this nachala, this inheritance, before everybody else. Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to show you, you're also going to go into Galus before everybody else as well. So the bottom line, the sum total of the picture that we get of the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven is overwhelmingly a negative one. They were really wrong in what they did. Again, we quoted the Ramban in Parshas Chukas a few weeks back, when the Ramban says that the truth is Moshe Rabbeinu was not interested in giving Eiver HaYarden, the eastern side of the Jordan River, to anyone. They conquered it from Sichon and Og, mostly because Sichon attacked them first. But in point of fact, Moshe Rabbeinu would have been very, very happy to not conquer it to begin with. And once he conquered it, to leave it empty. You know, they could have, I don't know what they could have done over there, you know, they could have had camps, you know, something like that, you know, for summer camps. But all the Nachalas would have been on the western side of the Jordan River. He was really not interested in giving anything to the Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven, or anybody else. They pushed, to some extent, they pushed inappropriately. And Klal Yisrael always looked at them with a jaundiced eye, and they're taka punished, according to this pasuk in Mishlei, for the fact that they took their Nachala first. The one piece of evidence that seems to go in the other direction is a pasuk at the very end, or almost at the very end, of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. The Parshas V'zos HaBracha, as we know, Moshe Rabbeinu is blessing Klal Yisrael and he extends unique brachos to each of the Shvatim. And when he gets to God, he says as follows: "Ulagod Omar, Baruch Marchiv God." Concerning God, Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Blessed is Hashem who expands the boundaries of God. Kelavi Shachin, he rests like a lion. V'taraf Zroa af Kodkod." And when God fights against his enemies, he rips off the arm together with the head. Because the people of God were ferocious fighters. That's what we see in these psukim. They, Klal Yisrael, were happy to have them going in the front lines. And they were such ferocious fighters, they would come into contact with the enemy, they'd rip off the head and the arm all at once. Then Moshe Rabbeinu says as follows: "Vayar reishis lo." God saw the first should go to him. What does that mean? Says Rashi. Ra lito lo chelek be'eretz Sichon ve'og, shireishis kibush ha'aretz. God saw fit to take a portion in the land of Sichon and Og, the first part of Eretz Yisrael, which had been conquered, in other words, the eastern side of the Jordan River. God went and took his portion first. Why? Kisham chelkas mechokek sofon. What's that? Says Rashi as follows. Kisham, because in that place, chelkas, a certain portion, says Rashi, ki yoda asher sham benachloso chelkas sode kivuras mechoke. God took the portion that he did because the Shevet, the tribe of God, knew that the portion they were taking was the ultimate resting place of the mechokek, of the lawgiver. Who's the lawgiver? Who? Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he died, was buried in the portion of God. The reason, says Rashi, God was so anxious to take that portion on the eastern side of the Jordan River was because he wanted to make sure that the burial place, the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu, would be in his portion. And that burial place is Sofon, is hidden. Rashi says, Osa chelko sfuna utzmuno mikoberio. No one knows exactly where that burial place is. Shenemar v'lo yoda ishes kfuroso. The pasuk says famously at the end of Chumash, nobody knows where Moshe Rabbeinu was buried. So God didn't know exactly where Moshe Rabbeinu was going to be buried, but he knew it would be somewhere in that area. And his Har Nevo, where Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, is in the chelko, is in the portion that was taken by God. God was anxious to have the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in his chelko, and that's why he took it. So the impression you have from this Rashi, by the way, the Targum Unculus gives a similar interpretation. Right, the Targum Unculus over here writes, "Iskabel b'kadmeso delay, are taman b'achasante Moshe safer rabbi the Yisrael kavir." He took his portion first, God, because in his portion Moshe Rabbeinu, the great lawgiver, the great Rebbe of Klal Yisrael, is buried. The impression you have from this Rashi, from this Targum, is that God, at least, was very motivated l'shem shamayim. God had very spiritual motives in taking that particular portion that he took. We read about how Umikne Rav, how they had a lot of cattle, and that's why they took these particular portions. But here comes Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of his life, and he says, no, you know, it has nothing to do with the cattle. It's ultimately about this spiritual idea. You know, I mean, if, I think Lahavdil, I'll say Lahavdil, if Uman can be a spiritual holy place, so imagine what Kedusha rests with the burial place of Moshe Rabbeinu himself. So the Shevet God, so to speak, they wanted to have Uman in their chelka, in their portion. And that's why they did something which on the surface looks unconventional, but really was motivated by this highly spiritual motivation. So before we talk about the implications of this Rashi, let's just first try to fit this back into the psukim in our parsha. That's certainly not what our parsha says. Our parsha says that Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven were motivated by the Mikne Rav, by the great cattle that they had. You know, there's no mention of trying to anticipate that perhaps Moshe Rabbeinu would be buried there at some later point. You know, so you're talking about cattle. You're telling me that it's based on Moshe Rabbeinu. Perhaps one answer is that there was a difference between the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven. So can put them together. But the truth is, as the Ramban points out, the Ramban gives a different explanation for it, but as the Ramban points out, initially, when our Parsha and Parshas Matos talks about these two groups, it talks about the Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad, and then afterwards, when they approach Moshe Rabbeinu, and they say, we'd really like a place for our sheep, it talks about the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. Maybe the reason it switches is because the motivation of each was a little bit different. God wanted to Reuven, as the psukim indicate in Parshas Matos, were primarily motivated by their cattle, by their sheep. In fact, Reuven didn't get the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu out of the deal. Reuven's only motivation could have been the sheep. God joined forces with Reuven. It helped them for their sheep as well. But here Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of his life, is revealing that their primary motivation was really something spiritual, to have the chelka of Moshe, the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in their nachala, in their inheritance. So in other words, there were two, they were partners, but a different thing was motivating each one. Question is as follows. If the motivations of Bnei Gad, at least, were very spiritual, so how do we understand all of the negative press which Bnei Gad seemed to get in the Chumash and later on in the Tanakh? The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is upset with Bnei Gad, okay, maybe he didn't really understand, you know, what was motivating Bnei Gad at that particular point in time. Again, it would have been a little bit odd and uncomfortable for the Bnei Gad to go to Moshe Rabbeinu and say, would you mind giving us this particular portion, because we know that your kever is going to be there. It's kind of an uncomfortable conversation to have with anybody. So, you know, maybe Moshe Rabbeinu didn't see what was motivating them so much. But how do you explain the Pasuk in Mishlei? Pasuk in Mishlei says that because the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven jumped the gun and took a nachla before everybody else, they were punished in this terrible way. They were sent into Golus before the rest of the Aseres HaShvatim, before the rest of the 10 tribes. Why should that be? The Bnei Gad were motivated by this highly spiritual motivation to have the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in their nachala. The Sefer Talalei Oros quotes the following, I think, fascinating interpretation from Baruch Shimon Schneerson, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Rosh Hashiva of Shabin in Eretz Yisrael. Shabin and Rosh Hashiva says the following idea. It's true that the Bnei Gad wanted the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in their chelka. It's true that on some level that's a spiritual thing. But it's a sort of misguided spiritual thing. It's a skula. In other words, it's some kind of spiritual aspiration which is a quick fix for spirituality. The Bnei Gad said, if we have the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in our chelka, so then that automatically is going to raise us to a higher spiritual level. And we don't need, to the same extent, to be focused on the hard work of ruchnius, of spirituality. We don't need to daven as hard. We don't need to learn as hard. We don't need to do chesed as hard. You know what? We have the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that will suffice. It was spiritually motivated, but it was a dangerous kind of spirituality. And for that reason, says the Shabin Rosh Hashiva, for that reason the Bnei Gad were punished. even though on the surface it seemed like they were looking to do something which was incredibly spiritual, you know, the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu is such a beautiful thing. But when the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu, when any kind of skula, when any kind of get rich quick scheme or get spiritual quick scheme comes in place of the hard work of Ruchnius, so that's a recipe for disaster. The guy who ties the red string around his wrist and figures, okay, that's going to protect me. You know, don't have to learn, don't have to daven. I got the red string. They told me it was a skula. So the person is missing out on what's ikker, what's fundamental, and instead substituting something which is, you know, seems to be spiritual on the surface, but in the end of the day is really something quite empty. There are no shortcuts to Ruchnius. There are no shortcuts to spirituality. If we want to grow, we have to work hard. Skulas have a role. Skulas sometimes can remind us that we have to work hard. They can sometimes be very tangible ways of reminding us that we're supposed to do the hard work. But if we're not going to put in the hard work, the skula by itself, to say, you know, I have Moshe Rabbeinu's kever in my backyard, that not only is not a positive thing, but in many, many ways it could be a negative thing, because it's a distraction from what we're really supposed to be focusing on. You know, believe it or not, before we know it, it's going to be Rosh Hashanah. One of the oldest skulas associated with Rosh Hashanah is the Gemara. It's the Gemara in Harius, where the Gemara says, and again we carry out some version of this to this day, that Simona Milsa, that the various different items which you eat on Rosh Hashanah can be good omens for the upcoming year. You eat leek, squash, zucchini, you know, you have all different kinds of simonim that we eat on Rosh Hashanah, each one symbolizing a different idea. How does that work? How does that fit in with the idea that we're presenting from the Chavina Rosh Hashiva? It seems like a shortcut to Ruchnius. You know, so you're going to... I have two paths to have a good year. I can either do tshuva and work on myself and give tzedakah and learn and daven hard and do chesed, or I can eat a fish head. Now, the truth is some people are disgusted by fish heads. They'd actually rather do all the hard work. That's the other option. But it doesn't seem equal. What do you mean? I can just have a fish head and that's going to make my year be a wonderful year? How does that work? It's voodoo? It's magic? How's that supposed to work? The Mishnah Berurah quotes the Shalom HaKadosh as saying that on each of the simonim that a person eats, he should internally do tshuva and daven that in the schus of his tshuva, he should be blessed with a good year. Meaning, the fish head in its own right is just a fish head. But if the fish head reminds you that I want a good year, I want to be, this should be a year where nifre v'nirba kedogim, we should multiply like fish, ani el rosh v'lo lezonav, we should be a head and not a tail. But you know, how am I going to achieve that? The only way for me to achieve that is with hard work. So then the fish head has a purpose, it's a means to an end. Had the Bnei God approached Moshe Rabbeinu with the thought that we can have the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu in our nachala as a means to an end, we'll walk by the kever, we'll remind ourselves of the Adam Gadol that Moshe Rabbeinu was, and that will spur us on to greatness. So that might have had value. But we know that that wasn't their kavana. How do we know that that wasn't their kavana? Because there was no way to walk by the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu. V'lo yada ish es kvurasa. Nobody knew where Moshe Rabbeinu was buried. So the only thing they wanted out of Moshe Rabbeinu's kever was not inspiration, because there was nowhere to go. What they wanted to get out of the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu was magic. They wanted to have a magical skula through the kever of Moshe Rabbeinu that would somehow elevate them without them having to do anything. That's implicit, if you go back to the Pasuk in Bezos HaBracha, that's implicit in the very Pasuk with which Moshe Rabbeinu blesses the tribe of God. Kisham chelkas mechokek Safon. They wanted to have this Nachala because there the kever of the Mechokek, of the lawgiver of Moshe Rabbeinu, is Safon, is hidden. They didn't want it to be a living place of inspiration. We know in Yiddishkeit there is a concept of going to Kivrei Tzadikim, of going to the burial places of Tzadikim. It's supposed to be a place where there's Kedusha, where it can inspire us. That's because you come to the Kever of a Tzadik, you recognize the Kever of the Tzadik, you're inspired to try to follow in the ways of that particular Tzadik. But if there's a Tzadik's Kever that you can't find, you don't know where it is. So clearly you're just utilizing the Kever of the Tzadik in your Nachala as some kind of magic act. It's just some kind of magic trick. And for magic tricks, you know, for magic's shortcut solutions, where hard work is demanded, that's ultimately something which isn't positive from a spiritual perspective. It's incredibly, incredibly negative. During this time of the 3 weeks, as much as the 3 weeks is a time of sadness, it's also a time which has the potential for tremendous spiritual personal growth. Some of the Chassidish Svarim in particular write that the Pasuk says, in Eicha, ko rodfeha hisiguha bein hamitzarim. All of those who pursued Klal Yisrael caught up to her during the bein hamitzarim, during between the straits. So some of the Chassidish Svarim write, ko rodfe Hashem hisigu Hashem bein hamitzarim. All of those who run after HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be able to catch up and to perceive and to latch on, so to speak, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu during this Bein HaMetzarim period. It's a time of sadness, but it's a time that can spur us on to accomplish incredible things. It's a time for us to look inward, to think about how we can raise ourselves, not just through skulas, but how we can raise ourselves through hard work, how we can learn better, how we can daven better, how we can do more chesed. And Be'ezus Hashem, if we're successful in doing that, if we can utilize the 3 weeks as a way to pick ourselves up, so then, halavai, we should be zocha not only to a tremendous aliyah and ruchnios, but we should see the binyan beis hamikdash, the restoration of that which we're mourning during the 3 weeks. We should be zocha to see that wonderful event, b'meheirah v'yameinu.